Okay, this is session one of Revelations in Joy, being recorded on October 20th, copyright 2010, New Grand View Incorporated, all rights reserved. And we're starting at, get this, 1:44 p.m. Hawaii time. So that's appropriate. And this became 1:45. We just made it in there. Greetings, Ion.
Good evening.
What's an issue, either Virginia or Brian? It can be a pressing issue right now. You want to go into the wind, Brian. What the heck is the wind?
Well, I'm still figuring that out.
Well, this is your forum to figure it out.
Yeah, start saying your questions or what you think it is. I'm going to go click on my King James Version. What version online are you using, Greg and Virginia and Brian?
I have a Bible in hand.
Oh, okay. What do you got, Greg?
Just whatever shows up on Google. It's usually the King James, Bob.
Right. Are you using the Bartleby.com version?
Gosh, I wouldn't know.
Okay, it's just at the top, you see the URL for whatever you're looking at. It should be Bartleby.com and then whatever specific thing. That's what Ed Long gave me, and that's what I used for the original recording. It's pretty good, but I don't know how to get other parts, but we aren't doing other parts. So I've got all the revelations here, and I'll just click on whatever part we're going into. So where is the wind? What chapter is that in, Brian?
Chapter
7, okay.
That's your first
oh, yeah.
Encounter with the wind is in 7. And then, of course, it's in 3. And there may be places, but I know in 7, that's where 144,000, that's where your first.
That's right. It's in the version, the King James Version online, Bartleby Version. It has chapter 7, and the first section is titled 144,000 sealed. Now, Ion, when we went through it, would sometimes correct the Google statement here, but it says 144,000 sealed, and verse 1, and after these things, I saw four angels standing on the four corners of the earth, holding the four winds of the earth, that the wind should not blow on the earth, nor on the sea, nor on any tree. Now, when we were doing the recordings on this, Brian told me later when he first heard them, he's yelling, Bob, what's the wind? What's the wind? And I never asked about the wind at that point. I think we found out later, and Ion told me that we didn't emphasize it then because there was more to say later. So just to get a dialogue going, Ginny, I should say this. The people present here are, do we want last names said or keep it secret?
First names are fine.
Okay, so we have Greg, Virginia, who we call Ginny, and Brian and Bob and Ion. So we're beginning with 5 voices. So, Ginny, what did they say the wind was about, you know, in your day?
I thought the wind was the opening of the portals, and that happened on April 15th.
Right, but I'm saying, what did you teach, if anything, how was this traditionally interpreted?
It was literally interpreted. The wind. I mean, literally, just air moving. I mean, it wasn't interpreted. It was a sign of nature. It wasn't a sign of any other thing.
So that you would read it that the angels were guiding the wind, sort of. They were part of the structure. They stood in the four corners and watched the wind blow or something. They were holding the wind.
They were holding it back. Now, you could also say that the wind would be the judgment. If angels have to hold or contain something, a lot of times it had to do with something that would be negative, like maybe they would say, it was the judgment of God or the wrath of God or something that would be, the angels would have to be intervening on behalf of mankind.
Right. And so I'm looking through the rest of the first part. Do they talk about the wind being unleashed? Do they let it go in this section?
Let me look and see.
I don't see that.
Says, I saw another angel saying, Hurt not the earth, the sea, the trees, until we have sealed the servants of our God in their forehead. And then it goes on to the 144,000.
And that's the first time the 144,000 are mentioned?
Yes.
Right. So then the question is, who are these 144,000? Would be the, we'll call it the conventional way of reading it, the human projection. Who are these people? Go ahead, Brian.
Well, we already know this. They're not people.
Yeah, the 144,000 was originally the tribes of Israel, or the numbers referring to the tribes of Israel, 12, 12, 12, 12, 12.
Well, that's people. Tribes are people.
Yes.
You mean they're not persons? I mean, so Brian's saying they're not people. You didn't mean that, Brian. I mean, they're tribes.
They're not people.
We're not talking about what we're going to learn from Ion yet. We're just trying to say what
it
was.
You're trying to lay out the false premise that they got from it, from here, of what John was trying to hold a marker place. And he used words or language to set the marker. And before there's a cleanup, this is based on where you are. Okay, very good.
Yeah, we should stay.
Okay, so the original, if you would say the original, you would say the original teaching of the church would be that here are the angels, and they're holding back the wind, and that they would not blow on the earth or the sea or on any tree. Okay, so the angels are basically holding back any kind of, like, quote-unquote, a disaster.
Yeah.
And it says, here comes another angel having the seal of the living God, and he cries to the four angels. So he's speaking directly to the four angels to whom it was given to hurt the sea and the earth. And what he's saying is, don't let go of the wind until all the servants of God have the seal in their forehead, and they number those which were sealed, and there's 144,000 of all the tribes of the children of Israel, and the children of Israel were the children who were born of the line of Jacob. That's what they would say, who had Isaac as their son, as his son.
Right.
Hey, Ion, please refrain from saying, right, very good. Just give us no judgmental calls. I would ask you to be behind as much as, not saying much, at least the beginning, as much as possible. Like, don't say anything. We're not interested in your opinion yet. We're only interested in when we need to get it corrected. You follow that, Ion? Because you don't need to comment on what we're saying.
Hold on.
We have an input here, don't we?
Well, hold on. All I would say about that, Bob, though, is that Ion has a much more broad perspective of what would be being said in the quote-unquote churches. And so if I'm off in my rendition of what I'm saying, I think it would be helpful for Ion to say, well, hold on, wait a minute.
Agreed.
What about this? So if we're going to lay down what the common interpretation is across the board, because you could even go on and get even more specific to what Jehovah's Witnesses say, because they have a take on it, and this and that, and then there's the Catholic Church. And so, I mean, just in a broad way, if I say this is what would be said, if I says right, that's right, okay, good, then what we're representing is a significant population of believers have been brought under this kind of an indoctrination. And I think Ion confirming that would be okay.
Yeah, it's like,
but
you
not,
say...
But not...
No, Ion, please stay. Well, listen, look, it's us four talking. And when Ginny says something, me and Brian and Greg want to find out what Ginny means. It may be wrong what Ginny's saying. It may be right. Let us work out what the heck we're talking about before you come in and clean it up. You're interrupting. I mean, I want to respond to what Ginny said. And I don't say that what I'm saying is right. I don't know if what Ginny said is right, but I want to respond to her words. And what I was going to say is, if I was looking at this thing, I read it for the first time, I'm going to say, oh, there's 144,000. There's some kind of special people. And I heard someone the other day on the radio say that in the end, you know, at second coming, 144,000 will be saved. You know, that's what one would think as you're reading this. Now, of course, there is what Ion will tell us, has told us, and we've all heard it, what it is actually referring to. But let's work out what we think it is. Before Ion interrupts and clarifies, this is for wandering in the desert dialogue
Okay.
among us.
Okay, so if you were going back to yes, there are people who would get on the phone and say 144,000 would be saved. That was the original premise of Jehovah's Witnesses, that this guy had this revelation that this 144,000 would be saved. And when they originally started building their religion, they, you know, two or three people, and they're thinking, wow, we got 100. Well, when they started to eclipse 144,000, then they got into a bit of a problem, because now the Jehovah's Witnesses are millions and millions of people, and they're, oh, fuck, okay.
Did they have internecine warfare among themselves about who would be the 144,000? Did that happen among them?
Guaranteed.
I'm sure it did, because it's all authoritative. So, I mean, I'm not a Jehovah's Witness, but, you know, they run around. And the thing about the Jehovah's Witnesses is their premise is that the kingdom does come into earth. The earth will be restored, but only 144,000 will be saved, and you're saved mostly by your works, which is an authoritative standard.
Yeah.
So because it's a, it gives you a measurement about whether or not you're good or bad or right or wrong or blah, blah, blah.
Well, let's refer, the Catholic Church had the first go at it. What did they think? Do you know what their dogma was about this?
I don't know, but we can find out.
Okay, I'm just passing. If we haven't got it, it's okay.
Virginia's on the computer, Bob, so it won't.
Oh, okay.
Pull something.
Okay.
I'm sure they had in their catechism.
Right, and so are the Jehovah's Witnesses unique by limiting it to 144,000, making a big issue out of that?
No, because it does it in, I mean, from Catholicism, which is kind of also, you've got the seven-day Adventists, which is different than just Jehovah's Witnesses. They have that. Let me look at the Catholic Catechism. But, there's 144,000 places in heaven, according to the Catholics.
Okay. So it's an odd idea.
And also in some of the Primitive Baptist or the Southern Baptist, the old regime, they stuck to the 144,000 as well.
Okay, so this is what it says. First of this is a good point. Yeah, I'm glad I brought this up. So all 144,000 people have to be quote-unquote Jews. That's right, thank you. They have to be Jewish because they come from the original quote-unquote tribes, and they are sealed to stay on the earth after the rapture, and so they go around for 3.5 years evangelizing the earth because they are the Jews that have been empowered. And then the New Jerusalem descends from heaven after the 144,000 have 3.5 years to go around and evangelize. So this is why there's also this huge messianic movement in the evangelical church, which they think their job is to get Jews saved.
Yes, because the Baptists, the newer Baptists, believe that the Jews are the chosen one, can do no wrong, and they will, quote, aid the Baptists in doing their thing. So even though the Jews aren't Baptists, the Baptists revel the Jews.
Yeah, and when they say Jews, they don't mean the citizens of Israel, of the nation of Israel.
Just the Jewish faith, I believe. The
Jewish
Baptists
faith.
I've talked to.
They're into being Jews, so to speak?
No, the Baptists will stay Baptists, but the Baptists revere the Jews because they, in their doctrine, say the Jews are the chosen one.
They accept that?
Yeah, the Baptists that I've talked to do, yes.
Yeah, so that's why in the Reagan era, the fundamentalist Christians that support Reagan, they were big supporters of Israel. Right?
Oh, well, everybody thinks that... I mean, Israel is, I mean, even the Mount of Olives, where the one foot is on the earth and one foot is on the sea, and, you know, where the Dome of the Rock is. And, I mean, there's all kinds of stuff about where that is and the parallels and, I mean, all the rest of it. So they think Christ is returning to that physical space.
Okay, so... One reads this, you can understand the early reader says, oh, this is a bunch of elite people, and I hope I'm part of that team and all that. Is this the section where Ion first brings in the DNA stuff? Does he mention it in chapter 7? Do you remember,
yes.
Brian?
Yes, this is where, because I remember when you got there, he brought up DNA, and you went on, and then you were rambling, and then you stopped, and you said, did you say DNA? Like, yes, DNA, because that's what they're talking about.
Yeah, and I'm going, how the hell can they know about modern science? You know, I probably had some kind of objection like that, right? I recall saying something. It was preposterous.
If I remember correctly, you had a big big resistance to that.
Yeah, I said, Jesus Christ. I thought, well, Jesus Christ. I thought, this is fucking Ion trying to reclaim, to bring this stupid old document up to date. So he said, oh, yeah, New York City's in here. You know, I thought that was really arbitrary and a hoax. And I'm saying, how the heck can one see the DNA in here? Now, I don't want to ask Ion yet, but Brian, where's the proof that it refers to that in here?
Just as when you went through it, Bob, the first time, and this very came up, it's like, okay, how from the words that are written in this book, in the Bible, in Revelation, how are you getting from these words that are written to DNA? And at that point, you're not into the later chapters yet. You know, Ion's response is, it will all out thoroughly. We're going to overlay this, and we're going to overlay it, and you'll see without a doubt that that's what they're talking about. And you just got to go with it.
Right. He does not approve it right then. He says, this is what you're going to find out, and we'll get there. Okay. So,
well,
now...
And then, so the challenge is, how does it quote-unquote prove out that it's not DNA? Okay. But that just the premise that's being asserted right now, that only 144,000 people go to heaven with 7 billion people on the planet, is so profoundly retarded.
Yeah.
You know, that on that sense, when you're looking at it, you're thinking, well, my gosh, how would that be? Then, you can see, okay, well, there's got to be something else because this doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, and so, you know, people didn't think about the Bible until they could read themselves. So then you start to read it in the West, and then they start noticing these things. And then you have popular education in, 150 years ago. The average citizen is going to say, this is stupid, right? You can understand why that interpretation of the Bible would weaken the church's authority. I mean,
one caveat to add is the Pentecostal or the charismatic movement. They started speaking of Israel. They deferred between natural Israel, like the country, mm-hmm. because see, up into the 50s, there wasn't no Israel.
Right.
There wasn't an Israel. It wasn't. It wasn't even a country. So they deferred it into natural Israel and spiritual Israel. They tried to make it a woo-woo thing so that more had a chance to embrace. Because Israel come up with anything, and then you're following, you're supporting Israel. So now all of a sudden, do any crazy thing you want. No. Wait a minute. But that's how they divided it for you.
Right. In other words, the children of Israel, for most people, for 2,000 years, they didn't know where that was. It was a nebulous place to project into.
Exactly. There wasn't even a country to be, for New Jerusalem to fall down on.
So what did they think it was? Some image in the Bible, I guess.
Well, it's what John laid out. Well, sorry. We digress.
Yeah, no, I'm just wondering what the image was that people thought. What did a minister 400 years ago studying this and teaching it, what the heck did his mind have for an image of Israel? You know, Ginny?
There could be two possibilities. One of them is that early on in the scriptures, I think that Jacob or Abraham, which one, I can't remember, Ion, is called Israel. So that's one. So it has to do with the bloodline and
right.
not a physical space. The second one is
Jacob. Jacob was called Israel. Didn't he get a new name?
Jacob.
Yeah.
Yes. Jacob got the new name, thank you, and that was Israel. So there's that connection without the physical space. And then the other one was that in the New Testament, that it talks about being circumcised. The true Jew is circumcised in their hearts.
Mm.
And so it replaces or it overlays this idea that there was a physical place, and so now it becomes a spiritual heritage because they're all received into Christ by being circumcised in their hearts.
So that's how they get out of the nebulousness. The nebulousness of the image is useful. Anybody can project anything in there within limits.
And then in the charismatic side, too, just sort of stirring that in, they called the circumcision of the heart the baptism of the Holy Spirit.
That is correct. So it says in Romans 2:29, but he is a Jew, which is one inwardly, and the circumcision is of the heart in the spirit and not of the letter. This praise is not of men, but of God.
And these interpretations come in with the printing press. The Catholic Church did not have a problem. It didn't interpret the stuff, right? It just mumbled it in Latin, and the people didn't even know what was being said. Correct? You know, in the medieval period, before the printing press.
Well, I mean, for the most part, that's right. They did the services in Latin, and then they, because most of the people who attended the church were the wealthy landowners, because they were in relationship with the king and the queen, and the farmers and the everyday people who were out in the fields and stuff like that, they weren't even getting it. That's why they were so terrified, and they were selling indulgences to the church, because the only way they knew how to participate was with cash.
So you're saying the peasants did not go and didn't go into the cathedral and watch the mass?
Well, they had a special section for the cathedral for the peasants in the back of the church, but yeah, a lot of them didn't. If you, Greg sent me this great movie one time called Father, Son, Sister, Moon, and it's about St. Thomas of Aquinas and his conversion into a more authentic quote unquote Christianity, and part of it was that the poor people couldn't afford to play the game.
So they were in the back to receive alms for the poor.
Yep.
And the poor people sold the indulgences?
Bought them.
They bought them. Who sold them? The church sold them.
Mm-hmm.
The clerics.
The monks.
So I get an image of, it's the way people watch Congress. They might vote, but they don't feel part of it, and the business people in their town is the ones who organize the allegiance to a party, and it's all run above them by elites, and they just see the spectacle called Congress, right? That's the way it was for the church, for the peasants. It was a spectacle that ran their world, but they weren't directly having any input into it.
Right, because I think essentially what ends up happening is that's the way it shakes out with authority, because it's about manipulation, domination, and control.
Yeah.
And so where is any kind of an authoritative posture going to come through poverty, which is why it says the poor you'll always have with you, because the poor are always going to be struggling within authority because they don't have an authentic place of power. Now, in a society, in a commercial society, or in the society of commerce, which is one of the reasons why we created the word anyway, was to do business. But in a commercial or in the world of commerce and in the economies, that way, the word was created to transact business. And in that sense, the people who had the word, the meme is the message, were the people who were controlling the world economies, period.
Right, and the word, yeah, what's the word? What's the definition of the word when you say they had the word?
Well, the meme, the word is the market, the meme is the market. So
oh, okay.
The word in that sense would be what creates the marketplace, which would be economies, which would be the word being generated in order to transact and exchange business or monies or barter or exchange. So the word in a sense, for our purposes in the spiritual work, is very limited because it was created based for commerce.
Right. So what strikes me right now is you had people for 1,500 years, not even, and, you know, grant there's no time, whatever, we're using what the conventional things. For a span of a long time, people didn't even know what was being said. So they're not involved with the Bible. It doesn't need to be interpreted. Then you got the Protestants who start reading it privately, and they're reading about in Israel, and they don't even know what that is. It could be anything. It makes total sense that we would not be able to begin to interpret the Bible until today. It's only been 2,000 early. The early years were the last 2,000 years. That's what's hitting me right now, that they could read about because nobody had the full knowledge. They didn't know there would be an Israel showing up in the middle of the 20th century, right?
Right. Well, and that's the thing that's so funny. Like in the, in the evangelical church, you have, like, for example, you know, whether it's like a Hal Lindsey, the Great Lake planet Earth,
yeah.
who's like one of these end time guys, and he has to be on his 19th revision of,
yeah.
you know, apocalyptic times, because every time they interpret it through political events that are constantly changing, but there's no relief for anybody to have an inner experience of their own divinity, because it's all subject to outer world events.
Yeah.
And
so
Bob,
go ahead, Brian.
Well, while you're on that little meme there about the timing of the interpretation, when you get in the later chapters and they go into 9/11, how is one to interpret that before 2001?
Yeah, and I'm saying that nobody had the equipment to interpret it, because for 1,500 years they didn't even know what was being said, among other than the priests. The people didn't know. It was in Latin. They just participated in the mysticalness of it. And then you have the Protestants working with inferior material. They're trying to figure out what the hell is Israel. And they don't have an Israel to refer to like we do. I mean,
agreed, yes.
Yeah,
and they ostracized the Jews. I mean, the Jews are in their ghettos for 300 years or whatever. And so what the heck? They must have thought, well, this Israel can't refer to them. It must refer to our concept of Israel. It must be the Queen Elizabeth or something. You know, you can see the crazy subjectivity. They hadn't even begun.
Right, and
yeah.
I think that's what's so just amazingly powerful about what Ion has laid out is, you know, The good news, the gospel, the good news of Jesus Christ was and is supposed to be a universal message to all of mankind, that the ascension process is available to everyone. And the Ion's message is the only message that does not exclude a population, a gender, and a preference or anything.
Or a species.
Or a species. That's right, because it starts at, that's exactly right.
You got the lizard people, you got the Lemurians. So what's interesting is that you read this chapter 7, it's all paranoia. It's only 144,000 going to make it, and they're going to unleash this crap on you. Better be a member of that team and get on the spaceship and get the hell out of here. You know, what a crazy paranoid scenario it was.
Yeah, and to get back where we were before about how do you get to DNA based on the words that they're speaking? And how Virginia was saying, look, which I thought also when I was going through it was, how can, when you think of the masses, how can only 144,000, you know, quote,
make it,
get ascended, make it, when there's 7 billion people on the earth? Okay, now, and then the question is, how do you get to the DNA? Well, in this whole process, and we've all heard Ion say it over and over and over, this is an individual process. And every human being has DNA, has 144,000, even though it's dormant, but everyone has it. Everyone has the DNA, everyone has the 144,000, and now it's the process of activating what we're going to get into.
And that's what Ion lays out in the very first 2 hours of talking about Revelations. There, Jenny and I were listening to it the last couple of days, and, you know, we isolated 4 things that were predominant through all of Revelation, and one was, of course, the false premise of time. One was that you already have it. You got it all. Nothing else going on. And Ion brought in power and authority. And what was the fourth one?
We had them earlier. The false premise of time, power and authority, you already have it. Oh, and the key of David. Oh, no, that was power and authority. Wait a minute. We've got another one.
The blood.
Oh, the blood. There you go. Thank you.
Okay, so those 4 aspects are in the first 2 chapters.
Yeah, yes. All there.
And you're saying you notice those are the things that are echoed all the way through.
All the way through,
without.
Right. So if I think of looking at chapter 7 and say, what the heck, how does this relate to DNA? And think of, well, that's many chapters down the way. But if I mapped out on my carpet here, every page, everything, all one big, you know, placard, then, you know, I can jump from one to one and they resonate and echo like your 4 themes. If we, So, yeah, we're going to reshape this by showing that Chapter 7 is explained right beside it in Chapter 14, which is right there. If you laid them all out on a big floor and saw them as together rather than linear, you know what I mean?
Yes.
And we were going to work out the seven, all the different types of seven.
I think that's cool, too, because I like all the sevens going across with the candles, the seals, and all that. I think that's great so that they all across. And the other one is the role of the angels, which I thought that the observation, that the revelation is predominantly about the role of man's relationship to the angels was freaking profound. I mean, that is off the freaking charts.
Yeah, it's like... Go ahead, Brian.
23 profound. That's the reason 23. When I got to 23, that's what made me realize, me personally realize that now I know why all this angel stuff is just in your face constantly all through the first 22 chapters. Angels were doing everything. Then when you get to 23, for me, I knew why.
Right.
I knew why. It was because God was directing everything through the angels.
Yeah, John the Revelator oscillates between being someone who's ascending and someone who is ascended and knows the whole process. And he's just watching, he's in the audience watching the angels act out the whole drama. He's watching the angels be the actors.
Right, and the relationship with the angels, which is so profound because, you know, if you did not have that perspective, you would have the perspective of the church with a little man, which is that, you know, this is about your relationship to authority. This is about your relationship to dogma.
What do you mean by your statement when you were talking about John was watching the angels be the actors, or what?
Yeah, since the angels are doing everything all the way through the 22 chapters, and John's watching them, he may be either evoking them, that's another issue, or he's just watching what happens when you're sitting in your throne and watching how the angels do their three aspects, communicate, smote, and help, Lucifer helps. He's watching them do it in this crisis period.
Right.
Little men.
Right, but the thing, I wouldn't call it acting, it's everything the angels do is directed by God, which is you.
Yeah, and so when you think, when I was going through with Ion, John, sometimes he would be the unknowing, the little man. Other times he seemed to know what was going on and just laying it out for us. Did you notice that? It would oscillate back and forth.
Oh, Bob, one thing I'd just stir in a little bit, because that's probably the best point so far, is you've seen this before, the way Thoth with the tablets would kind of run you around the mountain.
Right.
Nostradamus would run you around the mountain. You got to remember, John was hiding Patmos because they was going to string up his butt anyway.
Right.
So he knew if it was going to get ugly, he would give room for interpretation, if that's the way you say it.
Yeah.
So that it could sort of go around the mountain a bit.
Yeah, it's like Joyce when Ulysses got, that came up in 1922 and it got banned and it never saw the light of day till 1934 and it was smuggled. So then he was working on his second book and the Nazis are taking over Europe in the early 30s. That is one practical reason why he wrote it as his gobbledygook, because he didn't want to get in trouble, any more trouble. So I think of him writing that, that's what John was doing. He was being cagey about it.
Yeah, a little bit. Not like you say, he'd have moments where he'd just lay it out, but at the same time, there was always that prophetic spur, and like the what titles and what things were named. Like, why would he choose trumpets or vials or seals, or why those things would be called those things? You see, kind of gives I'd say a pneumatic twist to it. So you had room where you could say, no, that was talking about trumpets, or no, that's
right.
Bowls.
Yeah, so he's
sort
writing
of play with that a little bit. He was a little interplay, phatic interplay.
Yeah, he's writing it to cover his ass in case he gets caught, and he is writing it from a very knowing. He's experienced it. He knows how to call forth the angels, and he's telling other people how to do it and what happens, but he's pretending that he didn't know, occasionally leaving that in there. Oh, I just was told this, so to speak.
Yeah, because you got
to
know this is the day they had sort of eased up on crucifixion. It took too long. They just set you on fire, burn you up. So that was, you know, a little more big than just hanging out for a crucifixion.
Okay, so Ginny, did you ponder that? What we're just talking about now, did you notice that? Do you have a statement to make about that? How that's nowhere near anybody would read the Bible normally, right, traditionally. Or is it that way? How did people read John? What did they think he was doing?
Well, I think the couple things was, number one, because it was at the end of the Bible, as Ion pointed out from the beginning.
Yeah.
Because it was the end, it seemed like it was a culminating point of what the first Jesus, which they don't even know there was three, had done. So that was one aspect,
like,
of it.
He was the guy who came in at the end and wrapped it up and told us what happened, sort of thing.
That's right. So it was a concluding place. It wasn't a beginning place.
He was actually, he came too late. If I remember how I thought about it, I mean, the disciples were there. They did it. They acted out. But John, in the dark days later, said, well, they're all going to get nailed. They should have followed Jesus, and they didn't. And here's what, you know, he's the cleanup guy, almost. You know what I mean? He's not even directly involved. He's sort of later. I used to think, oh, he was 100 years later, and he wrote this because he was pissed or something.
Well, and notice it isn't St. John either.
Right. Yeah, you see
John
that
the Revelator. It's a difference.
That's a good point. How did the Catholic Church view his contribution? Well, they did put it in. I mean, they did canonize it, so they did put it in, so they had some respect for it. But,
Yeah, he was not St. John, who, when I, you know, I read the Bible through about 60 years ago, you know, read it all the way through, just made sure I read it a bit every day. I didn't know what I got out of it, basically nothing. But though it might have had some effect, you know, something, who knows, maybe he said, yeah, better be a good boy or something.
Sounds like cash flow today, doesn't it, folks?
Oh, yeah. It served me well. It served me well not knowing anything. But I used to wonder, who's this John? Is he the John who hung out with Jesus? You know, I used to be even confused on that. But then I heard later that he wasn't another John, but he was a guy who came late, you know?
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay, so Ginny, so what we're hearing about John is, so he's the main guy. He's better than the stupid disciples who are hanging around with the third Jesus. That's a new point, isn't it, Ginny, in the Bible world?
Well, yeah. It's based upon the premise that we have this dormant power within us, and if the whole premise of the Bible is to bring us into our power, then I agree with that statement. But the Catholic Church sure as shit wasn't into promoting anybody coming into their power, because from the very beginning you were a rotten scumbag, in the eyes of God, and if you get baptized, well, maybe you'll at least not go to hell. Yeah, I agree, but...
Hey, great. I mean, look at it this way. For 1,500 years, the Bible, the Catholics carried around this manuscript and, you know, chained it to the altar. Nobody could get near it and read it. It's like an update of the Ark of the Covenant. It's a sacred artifact that that the peasants couldn't interact with. It was like if somebody had an iPhone, you know, 100 years ago, and everybody around the elite, you know, worship the iPhone, but everybody else didn't know what was going on with the iPhone. You look at this Bible was a new invention, a new artifact, and no one knew anything about it. They didn't know the constituents of it. Is that an accurate way, Ion, to interpret how they hypnotized the masses? Because they had this sacred thing that had power.
Well, it's the prototype again of the Ark of the Covenant. It's the power of God's Word. It supersedes everything you lowly humans can embrace. And you can't question it. You can't question the Word of God. No, you can't question it. And we say, great, but then at least you ought to get the Word of God that you're not questioning.
Yeah, but wait a minute. I'm asking about how did people think this was sacred? I understand the Jews having the Ark of the Covenant and having that for their Solomon's Temple and all that. But why? You're getting papyrus in the early days. Paul's writing out letters, right? And some kind of material, and they're going out, and people think these are magical letters. I see it as a new technique.
I'll go with you there, but then my question then comes, okay, so then how did the Dead Sea Scrolls change that concept that you're laying out?
Well, they did. That's now. I'm talking about the way it was. Why did people even pay respect to this artifact? I guess because the people who had the weapons and owned the economy, they made a lot out of this manuscript, and so it was accepted as a given prop in the elite's reality.
And the church was law.
And yet the Catholic Church then would include the Apocrypha.
They didn't, or they did?
They did.
The King James doesn't.
Correct.
Oh, I didn't know that. So the Apocrypha is in the Catholic Bible.
Certainly.
Have you seen that, Ginny?
Oh, yes, of course. Absolutely. Okay. The Apocrypha is in the Catholic Bible. I think that when you look at how the Old Testament was set up and the nation that was referred to as Israel, which was what came out of Jacob's loins, the way that the entire nation of Israel was quote unquote judged, or the quote unquote favor of God fell on an entire nation, was based on three people. It was based on the prophet, the priest, and the king. So the king had one role, the prophet, the seer had another role, and the priest had another role. And the prophet would be a symbol of the word. Okay, so, and the king would be the symbol of authority. So what would happen is that in that flow, if the prophet, the priest, and the king were all aligned and they were all obedient with the same vision and all went well for that nation, and if they were out of whack, then the nation was punished somehow or went into captivity or whatever ended up happening. So in the New Testament, when the Holy Spirit came to common man, it broke up that whole little game, and then each individual person was empowered to have their own divine experience or their own relationship with God. Well, in the way that it kind of happened to follow that same form in terms of what you were talking about for 1,500 years, you've got the kings, which were the landowners, you have the priests, which were the people who were ruling the church, and you had the prophet, which was the person who was interpreting the word, and they were basically telling every single person what it all meant. So it was still an authoritative position. It was not an empowerment position.
Yeah, and so the early Christians had the letters in their own little communities in the catacombs or wherever, and they're running around. That is hijacked by Constantine, who, it turned out, the Christians for 300 years were the only ones reading. And so when they started to get into a bit of a bureaucracy with the end of the Roman Empire, the Christians could be the managers because they could read, right? Isn't that the beginning of moving it out of this personal revelation, which might have been passed on in the oral tradition among the disciples and the Christians in the first 100 years, right? They were just talking about it, weren't they, and witnessing Jesus?
They were talking about it, and they were also using art. So if you go to the early, you know, those first quote-unquote 300 years, the oral tradition of telling the story of Christ, it was accompanied with art because a lot of people were illiterate, as you know, Bob. So they couldn't read anything, so they were having to be told through pictures and through the oral tradition.
So that
was the one who brought it into a more of a meme.
An administrative thing. It's like,
correct.
So, and so if it's the Bible's used for administrative purposes, that's 1,000 years wasted. I mean, it's got what we're learning about it could be in there, but it would not be useful to the people who use the hypnotic effect of the Bible as an ark, as a hypnotizing medium, as an external power.
I don't know if this history that I have is correct. Constantine only had the Bible canonized for political purposes to unite Rome for his own power. he couldn't have cared if it was Judaism or whatever, but he wanted to find one central religion, I guess, to bring political power to his area and say, okay, now this is what we're all subscribing to. Is that
right? And McClellan would say that was only due to...
So now the question then is, who was king when Constantine was in his place of power?
Well, wasn't he king?
Constantine?
Yeah.
Was he emperor? King of what?
Well, okay, hold your statement. Greg, the administration of the Roman Empire at that point of Constantine was due to roads and papyrus, right? And soldiers and chariots, whatever they had. That they required some kind of homogenizing thing because it was spreading over vast miles, which nobody had done before. So they had to have a standard salute. Okay, we all salute. We all support this thing called Jesus, which was a sign in a Bible. That's what I'm calling the administrative use of the Bible. Nothing to do with what we're talking about. And it strikes me how you could only know what the Bible was now. You could only know now. And maybe personally, I mean, on a mass level, personally, a genius could figure it out. But it's not the whole use of the Bible over the last 2,000 years is because no one knew what to do with it. It was used for other purposes.
Yes, control.
Yeah.
Control.
So then Ion brings in the word king. When you say who is king, why are you saying that, Ion?
Because that would have effect based on what Jenny was talking about earlier of the king, the priest,
mm-hmm.
and the different aspects. So it certainly wasn't when Herod was around, was it, Bob?
Well, no, there was a king, wasn't there? We're talking about the role of king.
Well, the king during Constantine's rule was not Constantine. It was, let's see, who was the king?
Wouldn't there be kings of different tribes and groupings?
That's right. But Constantine, as you said, Bob, was to merge them together. No, sorry. Greg,
yeah, he was the uber king.
That was how to merge them, you see.
Yeah, a constancy, a uniform standardizing. So he was king of kings.
Now, we are talking about Flavius, Valerius, Aurelius, Constantinius. That's the one, correct?
Yeah, the guy who had the vision is the
great.
The one who saw the cross, which I don't know if it's true or not, but that's...
He was the Roman emperor. Okay, but that's not what we're talking about. Who would be king of the Jews when Constantine was the emperor?
Yeah, that's before they were scattered in 580 or so. Yeah, so there would be the Jews in Palestine at that point.
Whoa. Now, wait, was there Palestine then? There wasn't Palestine then, Bob.
Mm-hmm.
Well, whatever they called it, I'm just saying that.
You're right. I'm sorry. I was just trying to be clear.
Yeah, the Jews. There is the Jewish religion happening, and they're not into this Christian stuff. Like, yeah, who the hell is the king of the Jews? That's a mystery or a confusion there, right, Ginny? I mean, who's the king of Israel? You've got the Jewish thing, and they're not even accepting the New Testament.
I'm looking to see who was the king of Israel.
At one point in the Jewish history, there was no difference between Christianity and Judaism. They did accept the same thing. And then at some point, there was a splitting of it, a more defined, so the Jews could say we're Jews and the Christians could say we're Christians. But at some point, according to the history that I read, at one point they were all on the same team.
No, there were no Christians. And then Jesus started being himself. They crucified him, and those that did not like that action were later called Christians. But the Jews never accepted Christ. He was an asshole, you know, a rebel. Get this guy out of here. He's stirring everything up. So they get rid of him. Those that were associated with Jesus and the disciples, they mingle, and then when did they start calling themselves Christians? They probably didn't, because a lot of them probably were Jews, technically, by birth.
I'm looking at this. Who was the king of the Jews, Ion, during that time? I'm looking.
We just brought it up. Y'all got to play.
Yeah.
Okay,
so Brian, I don't want to. Brian, if you don't like, if we're talking too much historically, which may be good, we're doing this in the beginning session because we're getting a context for this. But Brian, if you want to bring up other issues, we don't want to get bogged down. If you're not liking what we're doing, anybody can say anything on that level. I don't want to get bogged down with Constantine. I want to know what the lampshade is or something. You know, you can interrupt any time.
Well, Bob, you just went into this whole spiel about, you know, the all these different histories or whatever, and then but you want to know about the lampstands. I can't help you much when you go into the history thing other than, you know, what's laid out in Revelations as it was laid out. But, you know, I'm good with wherever you guys go with it.
Yeah, and it's the beginning part. We're just flopping around here. I like what we're doing right now. Do you like it, Greg?
Absolutely. I'm enjoying the whole thing.
Yeah. And, okay, and Brian, he doesn't know much about this history, never looked into it, so it's okay Brian's being silent. I don't want you to be silent and frustrated.
Oh, I'm not frustrated.
Good.
I'm sitting back, Bob. I'm letting you shoot your wad. If it wants to get calmed down, then I know we're going to get into the we'll get into
it. Oh, you started into the good stuff. You're saying this ain't the good stuff? Okay, but no, I get what you're saying. Yeah, that's what we're doing. I'm not trying to lead it, but I am trying to figure out, why are we, what is this Israel in the seventh, you know, these tribes? Like, what the hell is it referring to? And I'm getting the new impression or image or insight. This Bible was not, it could not be interpreted. It's not that we're providing a renegade interpretation. The thing couldn't have been interpreted until now.
I do have a couple of questions on the, since we're on chapter 7.
Yeah, go ahead.
A couple of the questions that came up. One was, Ion gave his title to this chapter, and his title was the 144,000 Jews.
Right.
Now, my question was, when he says Jew, and he, I mean, you guys went into it a little bit about Jews and Jerusalem and what it really means when you're referring to the 144,000. What a Jew is, and you know, and then the whole Israel and Jerusalem. That's one question. And the other question is,
oh no, wait, now let's do that question. Y'all talk about that a second, and we'll answer it, because otherwise you'll lose Bob, and then you won't get anywhere.
Okay. So
yeah, what?
144,000 Jews. Now we know. When Ion lays it out, 144,000 is double helix strands of DNA. So, and
yes,
he's calling 144,000 Jews. So in my mind, I'm thinking a Jew is a double helix strand.
Well, now, that's what the different tribes, you gotta go, well, wait, y'all supposed to talk about it for a minute. Y'all got any discussion before we answer?
No, well, you gave me a hint. I want to say this. When we say a double helix, which is two strands, there's 144,000 of those two strands.
Double,
correct?
Strands. That's correct.
Yeah, a helix. So there's actually 288,000 threads, correct?
Well, yes, but in a polypeptide bond, the thread is inclusive of a DNA strand. So
I mean, it's a Mobius, it's a loop.
Yes, that's correct. Otherwise, there's nothing to replicate against. You know, when the threads, it's got to be as a ladder.
Right, okay, it's all loops.
You have half a ladder. You don't call a ladder with so many rungs. You don't call a half a ladder. It's one ladder. So it's 144,000 ladders. Say it
right.
That way. Then it's
logical. Because when we looked at the picture of it on the computer,
yeah,
it would always be open at the top. So it looked like two separate strands. So there's two intertwining strands, and a double helix is a one thing, but it looks like it's made up of two strands.
Mm-hmm.
But it's one thing.
That's
a one.
One total. Like a pair of pants is one thing to put on. And if you say it that way, you don't get tangled up, because this will get little. See, scientists are just now figuring out what in the hell DNA is anyway. So it's fresh and new to go with this. Anybody else? Jenny, Greg, you have a discussion with Brian from that level before we jump in?
No, I'm good.
Okay, Ian, before you jump in, I wanted to say, as you started to talk, I remembered that the 12,000, the 12,000, the tribes, I can see that the, each tribe is 12,000 double helixes.
Uh-huh.
So that makes sense once we know that.
And good. Bob's good, because he's wrangled us right into the actual answer. Okay, Brian, the reason it's called 144,000 Jews specifically is because in the original Jewish, I hate to say the word, law, the point of this, so it is written, so it is, when this was scribed, they did this always, always, always as a point of remembrance. They broke, when the Ten Commandments were smashed and bit, broke up by Moses, they gathered up them broken things and put them in the ark with the bones of Joseph. See, that was their point of remembrance. The Elisha cup at Passover is to remind you of the Passover and the significance of the blood of the Lamb. The 144,000 Jews, this whole entire work was to remind you, Brian, that you are a God. And even through Asher and through Simeon and through all the Benjamin, through all the tribes, it divides them into 12 sets of 12,000. And so, therefore, they could discern which strand you were from, because that's the lineage that's trying to be outlined here. And all this is a legend to remind you how to put it back together. So when you get smart and find out what DNA is, and you create it, and you then instigate the science that validates this ascension process, you'll know to have 12 categories, as Bob said, through a tribe. A tribe, and they'll actually call it that once y'all get a little further down this place. They'll hear this, and they'll apply it as an aperture science to tribes of the bundles of 12,000 sets of double helix strands of DNA. So what John was trying to do was lay it out here so that you could remember how to put it back together when you figured out what the fuck it was you were supposed to put together.
Okay, but
okay.
Go ahead, Jenny.
So let's just take me. So in my remembrance, what I remember, I could say out of the 12 tribes that are named in the book of the Revelation, and you have the tribe of Judah, the tribe of Reuben, of Gad, of Asher, of Manasseh, on and on and on.
Simon.
The tribe of Levi,
mm-hmm,
were sealed 12,000. So
yes.
I am sealed out of the tribe of Levi.
Well, okay, and yes, and all that's for, dear, here's what that's for. All that's for is you get how DNA replicates. It rips, it goes so far to 23 chromosomes, and then pulls back and replicates itself. And that, based on the RNA, is what tells it what to replicate from a cellular level. Well, all this does is set the pecking order for how you organize a DNA chain of 144,000 strands to say you are of the Levitical strand. That means nothing other than on your number one of the DNA plate. And if you study that the way they do a single now, they can tell who the baby daddy is based on where they start with the points of the DNA mass chronometer of DNA. You can see in 99.9% can tell that that's the baby daddy because of where they start with that DNA replication in the child that they're also testing. So in a Levitical order, the Levites, the L, would be your first line. So you would replicate 12 tribes from your first line, which would be Levitical. And if you're Benjamin, that would be your number one, and then it would recycle from there. Because you know how DNA replicates from the RNA that's being giving information to it. It has to set an order, otherwise everyone would be identically the same, And if everybody was identically the same, then they might decide that you did indeed come out of a monkey's butthole rather than the tribe of Levi.
Okay, very good. Okay, very good. And then within that, the tribe of Levi has quote-unquote certain maybe quote-unquote characteristics?
Just the order. Just the order,
just
darling.
The order.
It's
okay,
just the order. Because, see,
okay.
Later Christians got tangled up with that. Well, I'm a Paul, I'm a Peter,
got
I'm
it.
A John.
Okay,
see,
okay.
I'm more God than you because I'm from John the Baptist.
Right. What? The order of what? It's the order of
important.
What?
The order of how the DNA replicates itself.
Okay. So are we talking about the actual blood of the Jewish people thousands
no,
of years ago?
No, it's just an example of how you'll read a DNA chart in your very recent future.
They will look at what they see and say, this clump is Levi.
Well, they will after they listen to this, but until then, they may call that subset one
right.
of 12. And see, Brian might be a Benjamin. Actually, he is. Brian may be a Benjamin. Actually, he is. So, Brian.
So, wait a minute, Ion. You're saying that the terms Levi and the 12 tribe names do not relate to the actual historical Jewish tribes.
Well, they do for inference, so you can understand it now, Bob. They had to do it some way. They couldn't certainly shouldn't have nucleic acids named in Revelation for you to understand this. So
they made sure the tribes bred among themselves, I assume, right?
Well, not necessarily.
Oh, okay, you can cross over.
Hell, Moses went with the Moabites right out of the chute.
Right, right, okay. But I'm trying to figure out why are we... Could they be? Why does it have to be the Jewish tribe names if it's not related to the blood?
Because they had no other way to lay it out for you to get it now. It was just it's a metaphor, so you can figure it out for now.
Yeah.
The only reference they can go by.
Are you saying that this chapter 7 is what a student in a university would study in the near future as the layout of DNA and RNA?
Absolutely. Once your civilization kicks in, oh wait, sorry, it already has.
Right. Once lockdown Connie rule happens, then yeah.
Y'all have no idea, but I can't talk about that. But go ahead.
So, well, isn't that pretty amazing, right, Ginny? That these terms are going to be used. I mean, they can't use any terms. It's preferable to have this metaphor of Israel.
The whole thing is that way. That's what they say. They say every word of the Bible is the living word of God, and it's true, and every other word's a damn lie. Because it constantly, just like you accuse us of, it constantly undoes itself
right.
as it flows along, you see. And that's okay, because in that structure is indeed the answer. And that's why Brian has the specific question, which is on point, on topic, that this particular point gets cleaned up completely. Okay?
Right. So why would you call, when you call Brian Benjamin, what does that refer, what is Benjamin? What's that referred to?
It's one of the 12 tribes, and Brian would, his number one section when they test his DNA, because you all are of the leading edge, so don't think you won't get poked to have it. You'll be the guinea pig that shows how this is.
Yeah, like in the movie The Event, the TV show The
certainly.
Event.
Yeah, certainly. So Brian's will be his number first strand or first sequence. It's actually a sequencing.
Yeah.
Will be B or Benjamin.
Okay. So there's 12 distinguishable sequence
lines.
Differences.
Lines, that's correct.
If you look at all the kinds of DNA double helixes, you will notice there's about 12 types.
No. It's not 12 types. It's 12 strands, but you just got to know which one is which, you see.
Oh, the strands intertwine differently?
Intertwine completely into each individual cell, Bob. That's the beauty of this thing. There'll be 144,000 strands in every cell in your damned body.
Right, so you would look at a cell and see the 144,000 strand, and there'll be 12 clusters of types.
Well,
that's okay.
That's okay. It's a little bit more than that. But if you've ever looked at an actual DNA, it's a card with one strand, and it has little dots, three dots, two documents.
You say a card.
A piece of paper. Piece of paper. If they run your DNA to know that that DNA is individual to you, it has a little card with little dots. And
you mean the laboratory has a piece of paper?
Yeah. Right, of what they're using and doing right this hot second. But now that's a change. So there will be no way to keep track of it if they don't sort it by 12 sets of 12,000. And if you want to see a picture of it, if you'll watch The Fifth Element,
they
show it. They actually show what it actually pretty much looks like.
Are you saying they show what a lab technician sees?
144,000 double helix strands look like.
Well, in The Fifth Element with Bruce Willis. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, about 1999 or so. I saw that movie.
They lay it out.
Okay. Right. Well, what did they know what they were doing? Why did they show 144,000 parts?
Because that's what the perfect being had.
How did the writers of the movie know that?
They must have read Revelation.
No, they must have had someone interpreting it correctly for them.
Or they were just making science fiction and fine, either way.
Lucky accident.
What? Just like John, a lucky accident.
Yeah, like today in the show, Furry Lint. I didn't know it was Hedda Hopper's family name. That kind of linguistic accident. Right.
Well, accident, yeah.
But it's not an accident, I understand.
Right.
It's implied in the words. You're channeling the language effects.
Good.
Unknowingly.
Okay, stay on topic, Bob. Now, Brian, what's your second question?
Well, just to stay with this right here, okay, when you say your starting point or your first point of reference might be...
Of how they read
one,
it, yes.
But you have all of 12.
Okay. Yes, absolutely. But they'll have to be able to start somewhere to calculate, because
right.
if they have to find out if you're the baby daddy or not, they got to know which one to start with. Otherwise, there might be another 144,000 baby daddies that would qualify.
Yeah.
It's a sequencing.
Right.
You see, Ginny, I would be interested in going into a lab and having a scientist show me what DNA looks like under their microscope and then relate it to this.
Well, you could go on your lucky box and get a picture of DNA, a DNA result right now.
But, Ion, how would individuals who were, let's say, halfway, three-quarters of the way on their way to an ascending process, how would their DNA look different than the small man?
Oh, okay. There you go. That's valid. Okay. Now, that would be cleaned up, because what's actually going to happen is that's an impossibility at this red-hot second, because you're... Blessed science hasn't even ascertained that there is actually the potential for 144,000 DNA anyway. And if there were, if y'all got it, let's say you, Jenny, and Brian, and maybe Bob, I don't know, if he did, he'd never admit to it, but you got it, then you would come as a perfect being. But they'd still only look at one double helix strand of DNA. And then they'd notice something's up. You have no RH factor.
They'd notice that in the one double helix.
Yes. Well, they'd know the other anomalies in an actual blood test that you know, your platelets are different. Things would be obviously different. And that's going to begin quick, because this now becomes the by default setting that lays it out for the human creators. If they engage the power of the word, if they you want to get that, because it'd be no fun to get 144,000 double helix strands and have an eternity of misery.
That's right, because the strand, the cross rips the strands open, it works, the word is the word. So if you're going to use negativity words and negative anticipation and negative expectation, that will just accelerate your death process.
That is exactly correct.
But Ginny, there are no negatives, so I don't know what that
means. Yes, they are if they create them.
Yes, there are, Bob, because that's what you were reaming me about the other night.
What?
You were the one who told me that.
That there are negatives?
That chromosome 14 is a transformative agent, but it is not, it has no inherent quality to it. It's neutral in its effect. in the sense that it will be informed by the words that you're speaking, the song that you're singing, so to speak, in your body. So if the song you're singing is, woe is me, your woe is going to be accelerated, and you'll be woe and out and back in the guff quicker than you can say lickety-split.
Right, like if you call it, yeah, if it's woe, but the person may not think it's woe. They may want it. You know, it's nebulous about what is woe to people. From another person's perspective, it looks like woe, but I'm just reminding us that we don't know what anybody is. You know, we can't judge what their quality is.
But we're not judging it. We're saying that you want to embrace the word. So when you have the ascending, now see, Bob likes that portion, and I like ascended, and that's, Bob doesn't like that one. So when you start engaging ascension, you not only have the ability in your meat sack body to get back to where you were, you also have the ability to cease thinking, if that's the way to say that. So you have a chance to embrace your eternalness in your meat sack body. Because like you say, if it's troublesome, you'll be perfectly troubled.